In the matter of State versus Johnson, may we please have appearances? Mr. Blum, please go ahead.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Johnson was a good candidate for PTI. He was a 21-year-old, with no prior record, had a job, was going to school, yet the prosecutor mistakenly applied two presumptions in denying PTI. The presumption against PTI when a second-degree offense is charged and the presumption against PTI when a sale of drugs is charged. Johnson was charged with a third-degree offense, not a second-degree, third-degree school zone offense, and he was charged with intent to distribute, not a sale. Now, let me start with the second-degree offense presumption under old guideline 3I3. So in 1999, we had the Caliguiri case. And that case decided that the second-degree offense presumption could be applied to a third-degree school zone offense because the extraordinary sentence of a mandatory 3-year parole disqualifier. The court's view was that that made the offense very serious and more analogous to a second-degree offense. Then in 2009, 10 years later, 35-7 was revised to restore discretion to the sentencing judge. Now, under the revised 35-7, a third-degree school zone offender should typically receive an ordinary third-degree sentence. Now, the way the revision works is this. As long as the offense was not on school grounds or involved violence or a gun, the judge has discretion to impose an ordinary third-degree sentence or to impose the parole disqualifier. The factors the judge should consider in deciding what sentence to impose include the location relative to the school, whether school is in session, whether children are present. So the main thrust of these factors is obvious. When there's no connection to school or children, there should be an ordinary third-degree sentence. So now, under this revision, a typical school zone offender should receive an ordinary third-degree sentence. As the Commission to Review Criminal Sentencing back in 2005, they noted how, because of the vast reach of school zones, quote, fortuitous or happenstance presence within a school zone is typical, unquote.
But your argument to us is basically this. Caliguiri was written when the school zone was a mandatory jail term. It's no longer mandatory, therefore Caliguiri should not apply any longer.
I agree, and not only is it no longer mandatory, but it's going to be pretty rare if you look at these factors. And therefore, because...
So you just want to knock out the presumption, and you think this should go back for a hearing without the presumption.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because the typical third-degree school zone offender should receive an ordinary third-degree sentence, there's no reason to apply a second-degree presumption anymore to that charge. So that is our position.
Is it your position that he would qualify for a waiver under the factors under B1 if they were to apply?
Right. So I think Your Honor is referring to our alternative position, and that is that at the very least, the prosecutor should consider the 35-7B factors in deciding whether to apply the presumption. And here, if those factors had been applied, there wouldn't be a presumption because Johnson was stopped for a traffic offense that happened to be in a school zone. The officer saw heroin in his car. So there was no connection to school or children, no evidence of it. And in fact, just yesterday, I'm a little slow on the uptake, but just yesterday, I looked up the offense date of May 18, 2014. It was a Sunday, and the court can take judicial notice of that. So there was no connection to school or children, and therefore, because of the improper second-degree charge presumption, there should be a remand.
Should the presumption be stricken altogether, or is there a place for it when these factors under Section B do not exist in the case?
Our first position is, just clear, the second-degree presumption shouldn't be applied to a third-degree charge. But our alternative position is, if the court disagrees with that at the very least, the prosecutor should consider the factors in deciding whether to apply the presumption. So that's our alternative position. Now, I'll move on to the second part, which is the other mistake, which is the prosecutor also applied the sale presumption under old guideline 3I3. And that is, in fact, the word that's used in the guideline is sale. And now the plain meaning of sale is narrower than intent to distribute. Intent to distribute need not be a completed transfer, and a distribution need not be a transfer for money. So it's a much narrower word that's used in the guideline. And
so there is no statute possession with intent to sell, correct?
That's exactly right. The criminal code uses distribution as
so what does the state have to do in order to get within that presumptive field?
Well, the state has to be alleging an actual sale according to the guideline, and our position is that
alleging where? In the indictment or before the PTI director?
I think it would be as part of the PTI process. I mean, a lot of facts are brought in during the PTI process, a lot of allegations, a lot of facts. So it would be part of that process.
So you're saying the prosecutor never alleged a sale within the
prosecutor never alleged a sale, and it's difficult to see on these facts, traffic stop, how the prosecutor could allege a completed sale.
But just to be clear, on the PTI record, you're saying the prosecutor never alleged that these drugs were possessed with intent for sale?
No, there was never, and I don't see how it could be, since we don't know what role Johnson might have played. He could have been a drug mule who was indifferent to the sale. Now, a drug mule gets charged with distribution because they're going to transfer the drugs. It doesn't have to be a sale. But a drug mule who is probably very often indifferent to whether a sale occurs or not, that's not their role. They could be a very low-level person. I think that's one reason why the guideline was drafted the way it was to give a chance for these very low-level people at PTI. So that could be one explanation why the word sale was used rather than intent to distribute. And therefore, because we also have that improper presumption.
But if you sell, aren't you distributing it? Isn't it really subsumed for purposes of?
Yes, but if you're distributing, you're not necessarily selling, right? And that's our position that sale is a narrower.
But if you're selling, you're distributing. But you're saying if you're distributing, you could be giving it away,
right?
Giving it to someone rather than selling.
Because a distribution is any transfer, including sharing it with someone at a party.
But the other way is sales clearly distributing.
Right. Right.
I'm looking at the letter from the prosecutor's office dated November 7th, 2014. You're familiar with that?
Is that the decision Your Honor is referring to?
This is the letter to the Office of the Public Defender.
Yes, that's the decision, yeah.
So, bottom of the third page of the document, facts of the case. It's 16A. I'll just read the few sentences. The facts of the case indicate the defendant possessed with the intent to distribute a significant amount of heroin, namely 3 bricks of heroin, containing 150 individual dosages of heroin. Defendant is not a heroin abuser. These uncontested facts overwhelmingly suggest that defendant is actively involved in the distribution of heroin for profit, and thus is not an appropriate candidate for PTI. Does this satisfy the standard? It sounded like you were suggesting minutes ago that if they make this assertion during the course of the PTI proceeding, that's enough?
I don't think it does satisfy because there's nothing about his role. He could have had a very low-level role.
Actively involved in the distribution of heroin for profit. That's not enough?
No, it's not enough at all. I mean, there's no actual sale alleged. I mean, he could have been a mule who was indifferent to whether a sale occurs or not.
So
I don't think they're excluding that at all. I mean, we just don't know.
Are you drawing a distinction between the use of the word distribution versus sale?
That's exactly what I'm doing because the guideline uses sale, and the guideline should be interpreted as written. And one way I'm saying the drafters might have used the word sale is to allow certain low-level people.
So what is the what is the difference between distribution for profit and sale?
Well, they're saying that he was involved in the distribution of heroin for profit. So he's involved in the operation in general. So he could have been someone who was carrying the drugs, who was transferring them. That's a distribution. But he wasn't involved in the selling end. So he's someone very low level.
So if this sentence had read, actively distributes heroin for profit, that would have been enough? But because it, can you answer that?
Well, if it had read that that he had sold the drugs. But there's no allegation that he sold the drugs.
Let's stay with what we have here, because if I understood you correctly, we're not talking about an indictment. We're talking about an assertion of facts in the particular case. And I'm wondering if, had it said, actively distributes heroin for profit, that would have been enough.
I am not sure. I mean, I'd need the facts of the particular case. I mean, we're picking out these lines in the letter, which are sort of divorced from the facts of this case. And the guideline says sale, and I'm saying the guideline should be interpreted as written.
I understand.
A sale should be alleged. Sale alleged.
Are you splitting the atom here? I'm trying to understand how you can possess something with the intent to distribute for profit purposes that would not involve a sale. Explain that to me.
There's no allegation of a completed sale.
Well, there
you're
never
talking about
is,
the intent also.
Look, if there was a completed sale, the person would be charged with distribution. Okay, we're dealing with possession with intent to distribute, right? So there's never going to be a completed sale if that's the only charge, correct? Or
well, they could, as a factual matter, as part of the PTI process, allege that, but they've never alleged that, and they couldn't allege it on these facts. This was a traffic stop.
And now they allege at the end of, later in the page, under factor 17, defendant appears to be earning his living by dealing heroin on a grand scale. What am I missing here?
Well, they're not alleging an actual sale on these facts. They're inferring that he's some part of a drug operation. What
so
part?
They had to. They had to be the incantation of those words for this to apply here.
Well, guidelines are just like statutes are interpreted according to their plain meaning, unless it would be absurd to interpret them according to their plain meaning. And I'm saying there is nothing absurd about using the word sale in the guideline. The drafters might have used the word sale to somehow differentiate between lower level and higher level offenders. And of course, it's going to be, it's going to be a rough rule of thumb.
Look,
we can always think.
If someone had a small amount of marijuana, okay, and let's say he made a confession, I was intending to sell it. And now they said possession with intent to sell. Small amount. This guideline would still apply, no?
It would not apply on those grounds. He would have to say defendant had to admit that I've actually sold drugs, because the guideline isn't written.
Tell me how the guideline's written. Go ahead.
It's just written sale. It's not written intent to sell. It's just written sale.
Okay.
So according to the guideline there would have to be a completed sale.
Okay. So it has to be a completed sale.
That's the way it's written. And as I said, it's not absurd. So it has to be interpreted according to its plain meaning. That is actually all I have prepared. So unless the court has further questions,
you will not offend us by.
I know. I won't offend you by sitting down.
Excellent.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Ms. Rowe.
May it please the court. No one is entitled to PTI. PTI is a discretionary program designed to help first-time offenders oftentimes deal with problems that have escalated beyond their control, and from that, yielded their own criminal activity. But for their substance abuse problem, PTI participants might have gone on to lead crime-free lives. But at some point, someone sold them drugs. Someone introduced them to drugs, and somebody profited off their subsequent misery. Defendant is such a person. He's a non-drug-using drug dealer. He was motivated by profit, and to serve his greed, he sells heroin. On the day that Defendant was arrested. He was caught with 3 bricks of heroin, already prepackaged into 150 envelopes.
So we know that. Mm-hmm. And we know that the statute has been amended. And we know that if he lived in the suburbs or in a more rural area, he's not in the school zone. But if he lives in Elizabeth or Newark, any place will be in the school zone. And it seems to me that the amendment was in part attempting to ameliorate the disparities, some of them racial disparities, in the imposition of this entire sentencing scheme. Am I mistaken?
You're not mistaken, Justice Alvin.
So then why, given the change in this statute, where, as the Chief Justice went off of some of the things that we put you in the non-mandatory, should we not give the person who happens to be in this urban area the same opportunity as a person who's in some nice suburban area? PTI, same person. Maybe different color. Go ahead.
Defendant already received that opportunity. So the analysis underlining Caligari is that that NJSA 35-7 provides for a presumption of incarceration for third degree offenses when it's possession with intent while they're in a school zone, because we punish those types of offenses as though they are second degree offenses. This court in Caligari determined that it would be appropriate to eliminate them from PTI based on our sentencing structure.
So let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. If there were no dispute that the factors in B1 applied in a particular case, why would the presumption against PTI logically still be applicable?
Because those factors that are listed are actually used to not undermine or even destroy the presumption against incarceration. They're given as an opportunity for the defendant to rebut the presumption of incarceration for third-degree possession with intent to distribute.
So underlying Caligari was the notion that this was a very stern set of punishments that are going to be imposed for this offense.
Yes.
The amendment makes it less stern at the least. Would you agree?
Less stern, but does not eliminate the presumption of incarceration.
So, in a case where the judge is going to reduce or waive the minimum term, why should the presumption still remain for PTI?
Because the statute explicitly says that, and it should be read facially, that it applies to rebutting the presumption of incarceration. Defendant here already received that gift from the trial court. Because of all of the nice on paper factors that the defendant presented in his PTI application, the court determines that incarceration wasn't appropriate, but probation was. So he got 2 years of probation.
But that's looking at the end of the spectrum. The question is, when the assessment of PTI is being conducted, what's the reason that a presumption should apply at a minimum in the cases where the factors tell you the court is quite likely going to be waiving the minimum? Can you help us on that?
Sure. While they're waiving the minimum, that's still not a free pass to get into PTI. We have 2 presumptions that the defendant has to deal with, and the defendant overcomes the one. He presented to the court all of these factors that mean he no longer has to go to prison. In the court's discretion, he's going to get probation. Nowhere in the statute does it provide for this second gift of getting PTI, and along with PTI,
he's not necessarily getting PTI. The question is, does a presumption against PTI apply under the logic of Caligari, given the change that exists with Section B?
Yes, it still applies. It is simply perhaps weakened by the amendment, but because the underpinning of the analysis in Caligari, which is the presumption of incarceration and how sternly we tend to view, we start from a stern position and work down under NJSA 2C35-7. And because we still work from that presumption's not been eliminated, that part of Caligari still matters in this case.
So Caligari is our decision.
Yes.
So if we don't read the amendment as modifying Caligari, as it modifies the sentencing procedure, then we're not giving those people in the urban areas of our state the same benefit of the regular PTI guidelines without the presumption. The benefit.
we still have this disparity, this urban, suburban, rural, maybe part greatly racial divide. Like, why should we be perpetuating that? Calgary's our decision. Why wouldn't we modify it logically to conform with the amended statute?
The modification logically would just say that the presumption of incarceration is weakened, but it doesn't apply to the PTI decision. Or perhaps the PTI presumption might be weakened, but it's not entirely eliminated altogether, much like the presumption of incarceration.
So, you know, we're dealing with 150. There could be small amounts of cocaine, heroin, that are possessed by any individual in Elizabeth. Elizabeth is entirely in a school zone. Okay, under your particular paradigm, this presumption against PTI will apply to everyone in Elizabeth, but the few people in Bedminster. Is that a fair system?
Under this system, it's still fair that the defendant in Bedminster and the defendant in Elizabeth still have the opportunity in their PTI application to show extraordinary characteristics about themselves.
No, the person in Bedminster is not going to be in a school zone. Okay? That's all spread out. Everyone in Elizabeth will be. Is it fair that everyone in Elizabeth gets stuck with the presumption, despite this amendment? Whereas the people in Bedminster, most of them will not. Is that a fair system?
These are still individuals who are still committing crimes. It's not as though we're constructing a crime out of thin air. They're still choosing to go through school zones and go through public housing zones with heroin. It's still against the law to possess the heroin, and it doesn't seem fair to diminish a presumption that's designed to harshly punish behavior that we as a society still view as reprehensible.
Is it fair if the purpose is to protect children, the fact that they're racial, suburban, urban, there are more children in school zones in Elizabeth than somewhere in the countryside, if the purpose is to make it a stronger crime and no PTI because you're near school children, because the purpose is to protect school children, it's fair regardless of where it is, isn't it?
That's exactly it. That it's still reprehensible to bring drugs into a place where children are likely to be. Even including, I should mention, on the weekends, because still clubs meet on the weekends, children play on playgrounds at schools on the weekends.
The Chief Justice has read off those factors. If the factors actually apply, then you're still going to get the mandatory sentence. For instance, if it happens on drug property, you're going to get the mandatory sentence.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
School property, right?
The school property.
You said drug property.
I said what?
You said drug property. You meant school
property. I said drug property.
Yeah.
On school property. The Chief Justice has gone over the factors with you. I mean,
yes.
You only get out of the mandatory if you're able to be relieved according to those statutory factors.
Correct? Right, you'd be able to be relieved, and defendant here was relieved of the presumption of incarceration. He did get the benefit of those factors. It was recognized that children weren't present, that he wasn't actively selling to children. He already received the benefit of those, and it still remains that the presumption that Caligari relies on exists in a weakened state, perhaps, but it still exists.
But nobody's suggesting that the prosecutor doesn't still have the same degree of discretion, which is it's great in the case of PTI, correct?
Indeed, it's been described as enhanced deference, extra deference. This court has said rarely overturned.
I'm familiar with that. So, and nobody's suggesting that this individual, based on the exercise of discretion by the prosecutor, wouldn't still be ineligible for PTI.
In fact, the aggravating factors that the prosecutor cited reflect that.
One of the things I always questioned about presumptions is that presumptions sort of take discretion away, where prosecutors typically, by its nature, exercise almost complete discretion in the admittance to or rejection from PTI. Why doesn't it make sense to simply say, no presumption here, it's still in the prosecutor's discretion, that if this is a significant drug dealer that, for all the reasons you've expressed, shouldn't be in PTI, he's still not getting into PTI. Why would the AG be arguing against eliminating or curtailing this deprivation of discretion?
It's not to say that my office would have, actually, and at the time that I originally litigated this case, it's my former office. It's not to say that my current office would have superseded on my former office and said, well, no, you can't apply this presumption. It is highly deferential, and perhaps if the prosecutor had reasons for deviating from the presumption at the PTI application phase, the prosecutor could have admitted him to PTI,
or with or without the presumption, would have rejected him.
Exactly, with
the exercise
with the aggravating
of their
factors.
Broad discretion, correct?
Yes, and the prosecutor here appropriately applied legal presumptions that were fully legal at the time, both with respect to Caligari and with respect to the guideline 313, and right. Then also the aggravating factors.
Why don't you address the second presumption now?
Sure. With respect to the second presumption, again, the prosecutor appropriately exercised her discretion. PTI guideline 313 is for those selling or dispensing Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 narcotics. So there's two reasons why the prosecutor appropriately applied this legal presumption. One, at the time, it was still fully enforced. The guidelines weren't modified until last summer, the new guidelines weren't effective until last summer. And as Chief Justice Ratner noted, in the letter rejecting defendant from PTI, the prosecutor specifically said that it was clear that this was going to be for profit.
Sale or dispensing. He's only charged with possession with intent to distribute. That's different from selling or dispensing, no?
That leads me to my second point, Justice Albin. As you sort of alluded to, there's no need to split the atom here. With dispensing, this seems to be a synonym for distribution. Distribution, while it seems to strain credulity that defendant would be giving away approximately $1,500 worth of heroin in prepackaged envelopes, I understand perhaps some skepticism, but at the same time, that seems like a bad business decision. It seems pretty clear on the face that he intended to sell. We don't wait around for people to complete a crime.
But our statutes make the difference. We have possession with intent to distribute, and then we have distribution. This says sale or dispensing, not possession with intent to sell or possession with intent to dispense. It seems to suggest a completed act. No? Offense of sale or dispensing?
I disagree, because dispensing can involve... Dispensing doesn't mean when you hand off the envelope of heroin to the individual. It could also mean all of the acts leading up to preparing to distribute the heroin. Dispensing seems to be broader than sale.
Do you have a definition from some dictionary that will tell us that?
Unfortunately, there's no case law on this point, but dispensing seems to be a more inclusive activity. And one doesn't just simply, out of nowhere, give out heroin. There's acts that lead to the actual dispensing, including the prepackaging that defendant did in this case.
So you think that a person driving in a car with drugs is in the act of dispensing?
Yes, they are in the act, and they just haven't yet... they just happened to be caught before they could hand off the heroin to an addict or a child. Yes. Quickly, the prosecutor finally properly exercised her discretion when she applied the four aggravating factors here, the nature of the offense, the facts. As mentioned in his PTI report, he had never used any illegal substances, and also when they tested his urine, he was clean of any illegal substances. So this is somebody who's, the facts bear out, purely motivated by profit. He's not going to go and use 150 envelopes of heroin by himself for fun out of the blue one day. This is going to be a situation where perhaps he's had some experience before. Factor 7, the needs and interests of the victims and society. While we don't have a direct victim here, we do have society and the need to, as Justice Fernandez-Vina observed, protect children. Just because the defendant chose to drive school through a school zone doesn't mean that we should reward him for his choice of taking illegal narcotics through a school zone by allowing him to
PTI. Back to what Justice Solomon was pointing to. The only issue before us is whether or not the presumptions apply. The prosecutor has the authority to deny PTI,
without the presumptions. And it can only be overturned if it's a patent abuse of discretion. That's a lot of authority, no?
And it is a lot of authority, but at the time, the prosecutor at that time properly exercised her authority by relying not just on the aggravating factors, but presumptions that existed fully intact at the time. And finally, factor 14, there's no rehabilitative value for defendant here because he's not a substance abuser. There's no indication of that, and he himself has said he doesn't abuse drugs. It seems that allowing him to participate in PTI would be a mere tax on his time until he'd have a technically free, conviction-free record, and he'd be allowed to return to life as normal. And unfortunately, Your Honors, the family and friends of addicts don't get to live consequence-free, and it seems absurd to allow defendant to do so. Thank you.
Mr. Blum was helpful in his response, and I'll give him a chance to respond to it yet again, in saying we can look to the explanation as well as the charges. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. And it seems the explanation here shows that while a sale had not yet been completed, it seemed like a sale was imminent given the fact that you had that defendant had three bricks of heroin already prepackaged, ready for sale in 150 separated envelopes. And this would be approximately with a street value of $1,500.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd actually like to just correct one thing, and that's this is not a dispensing case. In fact, dispensing is defined in the code at 24:21-2. A dispensing is a delivery involving, quote, the lawful order of a practitioner, unquote. So dispensing cases are cases involving, you know, corrupt doctors, corrupt pharmacists.
Prescription drug cases.
Yeah, this is not a dispensing case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court's in recess for 30 minutes.